That's Mexican-American conguero, arranger, and composer Poncho Sanchez from Laredo, Texas, and his octet with the title track from his 1998 album, Afro-Cuban Fantasy. Of course, Poncho Sanchez is on congas. David Torres, a great pianist. Ramon Banda and his brother Tony on timbales and acoustic and electric bass. Jose Papo Rodriguez on bongos, Francisco Torres on trombone, Scott Martin on tenor, alto, and baritone sax, and Sal Cracciolo on trumpet and flugelhorn. Sanchez was influenced by bebop and jazz greats such as Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, as well as the Afro-Cuban and Afro-Latin pioneers like Mario Bauza and Machito. He continues to keep both traditions alive. He's one of my very, very favorites. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead, and it's Tuesday, July the 22nd. We'll be talking about two things today. But before that, let's just get you hip to a major blow that the Obama administration has suffered today in federal court. An appeals court basically took a harsh blow to Obamacare, ruling that some of the subsidies that it issued to people through the Affordable Care Act exchanges were in fact illegal, and that they were not offered similarly to the state exchanges. In a 3-1 ruling, the U.S. Appeals Court in the District of Columbia said that the IRS, remember this was an we had discussed this, how the Obamacare Act actually was passed via the IRS, that the IRS went too far in extending subsidies to those who bought insurance through the healthcare.gov website, that it did not grant similar subsidies to people who went through the state websites. This is a huge, huge blow to the Obamacare Act, and it will, I'm sure, be appealed. But so far, this is the blow that the Republicans were looking for, and they apparently got it. So they're very, very thrilled about it, I'm sure, today, that their desire to basically gut the Affordable Care Act got a very big boost today in federal court. So that is, of course, going to be followed. We'll follow it up here. And it was coming because we talked about how the Obamacare Act itself just followed a highly irregular pattern toward becoming law and being imposed. So that is going to be a huge fight. We'll be talking in the second half of the program today about a glimpse into the mindset in the liberal/progressive world, and we'll be using as our case in point the recently concluded convention of that was held in Detroit of Netroots Nation. It's a group of new media activists, national group. It's been holding these conventions for many years now. And the keynote speaker was Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts. And we will see how we get from her speech a glaring issue relating to the reluctance of movements such as this, and even by Warren herself as a bona fide, a good housekeeping seal of approval granted progressive candidate, reluctant there's a great reluctance in dealing with this question of race. So we'll be dealing with that in the second part of our program today. But first, I want to talk about how Washington, Congress, and the president can be so resolute, so absolutely decisive and uniformly fast in the way they respond to wars and conflicts, in the way that they can marshal resources and come to terms even when they have huge political and ideological differences and even personal animosities with each other. But they can move fast on these issues, but not so much at all on domestic issues that are urgent. The case in point, of course, is the current situation in Israel. I mean, we have John Kerry, Secretary of State, even, you know, being quoted as saying, "Hey, I got to get out of here. I got to get there in a hurry. We have to respond quite quickly to this this major development." And of course, it's all about the fact that the United States is keeping it front and center, its supposed interests in all of these conflicts, the humanitarian concerns, and so forth. And these things are not to be denied. These are the articulated concerns of both Congress and President Obama. But it is remarkable that they can set aside everything possible when it comes to war and conflict. And they can find money where money needs to be found, whether it is about beefing up the military presence, beefing up the defense budget, beefing up the military aid and whatever else that needs to go in that process to make that work, to make the American interests basically work, to protect American interests. That's a blanket explanation. It's protecting American interests all over the world in all of these conflicts. In the first and now the second term of President Obama, who has maintained that the United States, just like most presidents, I mean, he has not departed from the script in that sense. The presidents maintain that the United States must be the leader of the world. No matter what, we have to maintain, as he says, the United States must maintain its leadership all over the world. And in pursuit of that, of course, there's a price tag. There's a corresponding price tag to maintaining leadership all over the world. And in being involved in all of these theaters of war and conflict in the name of protecting U.S. interests. And in service of that, we have Republicans and Democrats. We have the old guard and the new. We have the young Turks, and we have the old, how can, I don't want to say the word, but the old guard, I'll leave it at that, the old guard. We have them all coming together and agreeing, even when they're fighting like crazy with each other for dominance in Congress and dominance in the United States in the hearts and minds of voters, they can resolve these things fast. Everything is on track real fast. Most recently, we discussed this question about the situation at our borders, the refugee situation at our borders, which actually is an international issue. They're not saying it, but they're certainly treating it as such. But again, fast, $3.7 billion. Well, we don't know if you're going to get all $3.7 billion, Mr. President, they say, in this midterm election year. So there are elements still of that push and pull between the Democrats and Republicans. But the response to this was fast. They were able to hammer things out because actually, you know, come August the 1st, everybody's out on summer recess. They've got vacations to think about. The situation in Israel, fast. Fast. In Iraq, fast. The tensions with Iran, fast. Anything that involves war, conflict, making sure that the U.S. maintains global dominance, fast. Fast moves, fast decisions, resolute. Now, what is interesting about this is, with all of this fast action, the president's foreign policy decisions and foreign policy track record is actually in the toilet. This administration has an abominable foreign policy. Nobody knows quite really what it is. It has not really been articulated specifically. It is kind of a, you know, amorphous. We will figure it out when we get to it kind of thing is what the foreign policy objectives are. They certainly are not well known. In fact, just a couple of days ago, a poll by Politico proves that the United States, citizens of the United States, really disapprove of the president's foreign policy, which is a kind of a strange thing, really, because we don't know what it is. But they disapprove. In so far as they understand it, they disapprove of it. They don't want the United States involved in all these theaters of war and getting involved in all of these conflicts abroad. They dislike it intensely, according to this poll by Politico. But at the same time, they really don't want the United States to be out of the running either. So people don't want involvement. They don't like the president's policies. But at the same time, they don't want America to be marginalized in the eyes of the world in terms of its leadership. It's a strange kind of position to be in, but it actually mirrors the president's own vacillation. And so they are merely mirroring the same kind of confusion that the administration seems to be in with respect to foreign policy. Barack Obama gets very little praise from all sides, whether it is the Republicans, even in the Democrats. The Democrats are not particularly thrilled with his handling of foreign policy issues. And people are waiting to find out what it is. We don't know what it is. Except that there is this insistence by the Obama administration. Foreign policy seems to be defined as America must be the leader of the world. That seems to be the foreign policy of the United States under Barack Obama. America must be the leader of the world. Now, while all of this is happening and under the call of American exceptionalism and nationalism and all of these wonderful, lofty ideas, and the allocation of billions of dollars to support it, we have objectively a huge crisis within our borders. We have a series, I would say, of domestic crises. We look at unemployment. We look at the state of affairs of education. We look at the vast gap now between rich and poor. We look at the number of people living in poverty in the United States. We look at a number of social and economic indicators, and they're telling us that there is a huge problem right here in the United States. And if you really are about American interests, this is where the action is, right within our borders. Do we see the same level of enthusiasm to deal with that? Do we see them really hunkering down and making a strong effort to resolve this impasse in Congress? Do we see a strong effort to recognize that there is a, not just an obligation, but it is imperative that people move quickly on these issues and get something done, get some kind of results, get some kind of movement, some kind of resolution? All the attention is now, Americans are more now, you know, conversant with the issues that are going on in Israel and Gaza, or the issues going on with Iran, or the issues going on elsewhere in the world where supposed U.S. interests are at stake. And they are supposed to set aside the fact that there is, well, we're beyond crisis in the United States. We are actually, in some cases, in meltdown. We've gone beyond crisis. Anybody looking at the objective situation here will tell you that it is a miracle that the United States has not exploded in anger and in chaos over the kind of pressure that people are living with every single day. This administration, the Obama administration, has been, in my view, so disappointing, so absolutely disappointing in the way it has set its priorities and the way it just goes about doing business. You wonder, I mean, what are they thinking? What is the thought process here? What governs the setting of priorities? You mean, after all this time, a full term and halfway into a second term, there's nobody that says, is able to convince this president that we've been doing this thing the wrong way. We can't reconcile what it is we promised and what it is we are delivering. In fact, we aren't even delivering. That's people been telling you this over and over and over again. You're not delivering. And there are a whole bunch of reasons. We understand that there are, you know, pockets of resistance, but we understand also that this administration is incompetent. It came in on false pretenses. It sold people a bill of goods that we can get these things done, but it has been an administration just operating on this mindset that they're just so smart. They can outsmart everybody, and they are purely entrepreneurial. They're not there to really improve conditions of life in the United States. They're not there to make things better. They're there to first and foremost take care of themselves and their economic futures and interests. They're there to capitalize on their the strategic positions that they occupy to make the most of it and to set themselves up. They are people who have decided that they're predators. They're political predators. This administration has been mired in the culture of predation. What's in it for me? What am I going to get? I don't care what the sacrifice is. I don't care what other people have to suffer. As long as I make out like a bandit, literally, I get mine, and that's really what the major, that becomes the national agenda. The national agenda is how the entire nation is going to support the personal interests of that small crew that is in Washington. The people who surround Barack Obama, the people who created Barack Obama, the people who engineered his presidency and still control it. So while we have this illusion of hope, they're busy satisfying the agendas and the interests of a vast but hidden realm of interests, people that they're answering to, even now in Israel. This is not about U.S. interests. U.S. involvement there is not about U.S. interests. It is about shoring up a renegade government and fulfilling what they believe are the obligations. The priority is Israel, to shore it up, to give it what it needs. And we've had the president say this over and over and over again, that essentially, no matter what Israel does, it is our obligation to support it. No questions asked. John Kerry says in an unguarded moment, he criticizes the intense attacks by Israel in Gaza. And still, you know, it's about Israel. No matter what they do, they're not to be criticized. They are simply to be supported with hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. aid, military and otherwise. And in the meantime, the interests of the United States, the people of the United States who are suffering, there are Gazas right here in the United States. There are Gazas in the United States. And this president and Congress can't seem to move fast and furiously to solve these issues at all. They seem to have no interest. These are low priority items. And so I think people should start asking these questions. What is it that needs to be done? What other way should this administration and the members of Congress, what other ways should be taken to get them the message that we have noticed that in matters of war and conflict all over the world, you're able to make a fast and furious decision and resolution and money allocation on matters of pressing urgency here in the United States? You can't see your way out of square one. We come back and talk about Elizabeth Warren right after this. Elizabeth Warren is a Democratic U.S. Senator from Massachusetts. By every description, she is a forward-thinking, progressive member of Congress, of the Senate. She has been known as the person who singularly has trained her sights on banks or the banksters and has been consistent in challenging the coddling by this administration of that sector. And she was a keynoter at the recent Netroots Nation Convention held in Detroit. And I want us to listen to the speech. I'll come back to it to make some observations. But first, let's hear what she had to say at this gathering, this national gathering of liberal left organizers. Here she issues a clarion call for action on a number of hot-button issues. Elizabeth Warren.
You know, a lot of us in this room have history. We have a lot of history. 5 years ago, I was fighting hard for a new consumer agency to keep the big banks from cheating families on mortgages and credit cards. And I went to see a lot of experts in Washington. I went to try to talk to people about the idea for this agency. The economy had crashed. Here was one way that we could fix things so this wouldn't happen again. This is one way we could level the playing field a little bit for families. So I went and talked to these experts and a lot of people on our side. And they almost all told me the same two things. First thing they said, great idea. This could actually make a real difference in people's lives. The second thing they said is don't do it. Don't even get out there and fight for it. Don't even propose it. And they said don't do it because the biggest banks in this country will hate it and you will lose. Well, the experts got that half right, and that is, no surprise, the big banks really did hate it. I mean, they really hated it. They spent, are you ready for this? In addition to all their campaign contributions and everything else, they spent more than $1 million a day for more than a year lobbying against financial reforms. I mean, they really put their money where their mouth is on this one. But the experts were also very wrong. We fought back and we won. That's what we did. That's what we did. We won, and that's what I want to talk about today. We won because you and a zillion other people across this country got in the fight. We won because you got out there. You broke news. You wrote opinion pieces. You organized petitions. You built coalitions. You kept that idea alive. You called out sleazy lobbyists and cowardly politicians. You said, We, the people, will have this agency, and you are the ones who won. You won this fight. And you know, it matters. These fights really do matter. That little agency is almost 3 years old now, and it has already forced the biggest financial institutions in this country to return more than $4 billion to consumers they cheated. That's making government work for us. But never miss the central point of this story. The CFPB is proof of how democracy can work in the 21st century. It is proof that if we push back against the biggest, strongest, most ruthless lobbying effort in the country, that if we push back hard, we can win. We fight, we win. Now, I understand we don't win every time, and we're still trying to figure out how to make it all work. But we have united our voices, and when we unite our voices, we can win. We did it in my Senate race when Wall Street said they would send money to Scott Brown by the double bucketfuls, and we still pushed back and managed to win by 8 points. Thank you very much. We did that. We did it together. You did it when you got out there and stopped SOPA. You did this by getting organized and fighting back. No, we don't win every time, but we're learning to win. We're learning to win, and we will keep winning. We will fight, and we will win. That's my message today. But I want to talk about what we're up against. I want to talk about what's happening in this country. I make no mistake, this isn't easy. We can't win what we won't fight for, and it will be a hard fight. Today, many powerful companies look for every possible way they can to boost their profits and to boost their CEO bonuses. They try to run more efficient companies. They try to grow faster. They try to beat out the competition. But many of them have another plan. They use their money and their connections to try to capture Washington and rig the rules in their favor. From tax policy to retirement security, those with power fight to make sure that every rule tilts in their favor. Everyone else just gets left behind. That's what we're up against. That's what democracy is up against. Just look at the big banks. They cheated American families, crashed the economy, got bailed out, and now the biggest banks are even bigger than they were when they were too big to fail in 2008. They still swagger through Washington, blocking reforms and pushing around agencies. A kid gets caught with a few ounces of pot and goes to jail, but a big bank launders drug money and no one gets arrested. The game is rigged, and it isn't right. It's rigged. But it isn't just the big banks. Look at the choices that the federal government makes right now. Our college kids are getting crushed by student loan debt. We need to rebuild our roads and bridges and upgrade our power grids. We need more investment in medical research and scientific research. But instead of building a future, this country is bleeding billions of dollars in tax loopholes and subsidies that go to rich and powerful corporations. Billion-dollar companies take advantage of every benefit they can squeeze out of the American government. And then they put together sleazy deals with foreign countries so that they can renounce their American citizenship and pay no taxes. Billionaires pay taxes at lower rates than their secretaries. How does this happen? It happens because they all have lobbyists. Lobbyists and Republican friends in Congress. Lobbyists and Republicans to protect every loophole and every privilege. The game is rigged, and it isn't right. It is not right. You bet. Or take a look at what happens with trade deals. For big corporations, trade negotiations are like Christmas morning. They can get special gifts through trade negotiations that they could never get through Congress. How does that happen? Because trade negotiations are held in secret so that big corporations can do their work behind closed doors. Giant corporations get insider access to promote their interests, while workers' rights and environmental regulations are just gutted. From what I hear, Wall Street, pharmaceuticals, telecom, big polluters, outsourcers are all smacking their lips at the possibility of rigging the upcoming trade deals. Now, stop and ask yourself, why are trade deals secret? Well, I've actually heard supporters say they have to be secret because if people knew what was going on, they would be opposed. It's true. It's actually true from the supporters. Well, my view is if people would be opposed, then we shouldn't have those trade deals. That's right. That's right. You bet. The tilt in the playing field is everywhere. When conservatives talk about opportunity, they mean opportunity for the rich to get richer and the powerful to get more powerful. They don't mean opportunities for a young person with $100,000 of student loan debt to try to build a future. They don't mean opportunities for someone out of work to get back on their feet. They don't mean opportunities for someone who worked hard all her life to retire with dignity. The game is rigged, and the rich and the powerful have lobbyists and lawyers and plenty of friends in Congress. Everybody else, not so much. So the way I see this is we can whine about it, we can whimper about it, or we can fight back. I'm fighting back. I'm ready to fight back. Are you ready to fight back on this? So sit down. Come on. Sit down. Sit down. Let's talk about this fight. This is a fight over economics, a fight over privilege, a fight over power. But deep down, it is a fight over values. Conservatives and their powerful friends will continue to be guided by their internal motto, I got mine, the rest of you are on your own. Well, we're guided by principle, and it's a pretty simple idea. We all do better when we work together and invest in building a future. We know that this economy grows when hardworking families have the opportunity to improve their lives. We know that this country gets stronger when we invest in helping people succeed. We know that our lives improve when we care for our neighbors and we help build a future, not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids. That's what we believe. These are progressive ideas. These are progressive values. These are America's values. And these are the values we are willing to fight for. So sometimes we have to get together and we have to talk about what are our values. We have to talk about what does it mean to be a progressive. We have to talk about what does it mean to be an American. So let's spend a minute talking about what we believe. We believe that Wall Street needs stronger rules and tougher enforcement, and we're willing to fight for it. We're willing to fight for it. We believe in science, and that means that we have a responsibility to protect this earth, and we will fight for it. We believe that the internet shouldn't be rigged to benefit big corporations, and that means real net neutrality, and we will fight for it. We believe that no one should work full time and still live in poverty. That means raising the minimum wage, and we will fight for it. We will fight for it. And let me add to that. We believe that fast food workers deserve a livable wage, and that means when they take to the picket line, we are proud to fight alongside them. That's what it means. You bet. We believe that students are entitled to get an education without being crushed by debt, and we are willing to fight for it. We are willing. We believe that after a lifetime of work, people are entitled to retire with dignity, and that means protecting Social Security, Medicare, and pensions, and we will fight for them. We will fight. Oh, we believe, only I can't believe I have to say this in 2014. We believe in equal pay for equal work, and we're willing to fight for it. You bet. Yep. I'm going to do this. We believe that equal means equal, and that's true in marriage, it's true in the workplace, it's true in all of America, and we're willing to fight for it. You bet. We believe that immigration has made this country strong and vibrant, and that means reform, and we are willing to fight for it. That's right. Oh, and we believe that corporations are not people, that women have a right to their bodies. We will overturn Hobby Lobby, and we will fight for it. We will fight for it. Right here in this room. Right here in this room, this is where it happens. This is 21st century democracy. This is the future of America. This is where we decide that we, the people, will fight for what we believe in. We're going to do this together, and we're going to win. That's what's going to happen. Good to see you all.
Elizabeth Warren, the Democratic senator from Massachusetts, addressing Netroots Nation. That was on July the 18th in Detroit, Michigan. And, of course, as you heard from the rousing response that you got from the audience, which also, by the way, is prodding her, as is a wider audience, prodding her into a 2016 presidential bid. Now, it's hard to argue with anything that she has said. It is hard to criticize anything that she has put forward in her speech. Except that we make a very important notation here. Of course, you know, I'm always insisting that when we listen not only to what is said, we listen more astutely for what is not said. And even in this candidate, even in this elected official and would-be candidate, if she agrees, but I don't think she will run, we have a repeat offense, and it is time that it is corrected. We heard a list of all the things that Elizabeth Warren had identified as the major issues that need to be tackled and fought over. And we heard a lot of things about what the we, And she's speaking, by the way, Netroots Nation, the people gathered to hear her in Detroit as a mostly white audience. And she is sharing, naturally, what she believes are the common interests between her and her audience. The one thing we did not hear at all in terms of what it is, the we, as she, you know, enlarges this community of shared interests, what we believe in. And it would be so refreshing, it would be such a departure as well, to hear that we believe in the right of all people, not just in the workplace and marriage equality and all of that, that you address squarely the issue of racism in America, because, and the centrality of racism in American life, central to poverty, central to inequity, central to all kinds of social, political, and economic wrongs. And this is the very thing that is astutely avoided, even in the progressive community. They won't talk about it as being a major issue that must be discussed as a political agenda to which there must be a commitment to fight, because it is central to a whole range of evils that people have been living with and are being subjected to every single day. So I'm calling her out on it. And I'm calling out all of the progressive community. They will not deal with this. They won't deal with it. The assumption still is, and this is the thing, even as they recognize about all the struggles and the inequities and unfairness, it is still within the context of the white world. The white people are setting the agenda for the white world. And everybody else just has to kind of fall in. We'll address you, we'll take care of you. You just have to go along with what we come up with. Where in that list of things is a specific reference to the realities that confront the vast majority of people of color in this country? It doesn't exist. It's not even within the realm of consideration. And yet you're talking to organizers and you're talking to people who are supposed to be fighting on a whole bunch of platforms for a whole bunch of agenda items. It's not even within the realm of consideration. And that's what I said, I've been saying for a long time. The Democratic Party is useless. But we have these other parties that are also marginalizing people of color. There's no point in giving them any support, is there? The Green Party, the progressive movement, why should people of color be concerned about involving themselves in any way with these movements? When these movements just, I don't think it's a deliberate thing. I don't want to think it's a deliberate thing. But it is consistent. And that consistency would suggest that it is a deliberate thing. This insistence, this, we don't see that. We don't see these folks. We don't see their issues as mattering in our realm. We see, in effect, our realm to be our realm. We will, you know, selectively grant you admission, but you're not part of our reality. And we've got to call them on it. How could you make a speech like this and be so warmly received, which means that there is a sharing of ideas. There's a sharing of a culture here. There's a sharing of orientation, political orientation. There's a shared viewpoint, a shared vision. And in this shared viewpoint and vision, there is no room for people of color. And these are progressives. Now, that is the work that Elizabeth Warren and the whole progressive movement needs to deal with on their own terms. If in fact they are progressive, they would recognize that the time has come to publicly acknowledge the centrality of racism in this country, which is number one, their obligation to do something about it, number two, and the imperative to mount a comprehensive coalition-type struggle against it. That's number three. And until they do that, they are of no relevance to people of color in the United States. They are simply the kinder, gentler side of what we have been experiencing for centuries now. But it's all talk. If they don't have the courage to do it, they don't deserve any support. And they ought to just walk away. Don't even pretend that you have an interest in some comprehensive coalition type movement in which the rights of all people and the input and active roles of all people not only are encouraged, but are required to be recognized. So I listened to the speech, and again, you can't argue with any of the items that she reiterated there. You cannot argue with that. And I'm not suggesting at all that she is a bad person. I'm not suggesting at all that she does not understand these things deliberately. But I am very, very much saying that the time has come to not excuse these omissions, because done over time, done repeatedly, omissions become commissions. And that's where we are with the so-called progressive movements. They are committing acts of commission. That brings me to the end of our program today. I want to thank you so much for listening. And certainly you can send me your notes and your reactions on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead, or by email, leadstories@gmail.com. It's great always hearing from you. And I do try to keep up with my responses in a timely fashion. I try to get back to you somehow as fast as possible, so to acknowledge your feedback and reactions to the programming. And your feedback really does help. I really want to enlist your aid in spreading the word about PRN. This is a great station and a very necessary one, increasingly so. And, of course, selfishly, to promote this program as your necessary reference point every day on matters where you can be assured of tell it like it is commentary right here on Lead Stories. And of course, we have, I think, one of the best examples of a community of interests on this program, because we gather here for the vigorous exchange of information, opinions, and ideas every single day. It is invigorating, and it is a wonderful departure from the norm, and I really do cherish that, as I know that you do too. So I need you to become an ambassador for the program, an ambassador for PRN, promote the station, promote the program within your circles and spheres of influence, and let's grow this audience. I really would like you to know that we are moving in the direction of growing this audience. It would be wonderful for people to discover the benefits of connecting here every single day. So thank you so much for that. And of course, thank you for your words of encouragement. They mean so much to me when people write and say that the programs have helped them understand things a little better, or that they express a value in the programs. And it means a lot to me, because I do try to bring value to you every day. So I want to thank you so much for that. And it is always a pleasure and always a privilege, and I mean that, to be in your company. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.